The Great Plains began capturing people's imaginations even before the notion of manifest destiny was set forth in the early 19th century. Josh Garrett Davis has researched the region's historical significance for the people who moved there and the Native Americans who were already there, and how we have come to feel about the Plains these days. His book, Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains, is published by Little Brown. I'm very pleased it has brought Josh Garrett Davis our show today. Hello.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
You also explore your own roots in South Dakota and your family's Midwestern history. What brought your parents to that part of the country, and where have they come from?
Well, my dad was from the East Coast, and he'd grown up in an academic family, mostly in Ithaca, New York. And his parents got divorced when he was in high school, and he I think, wanted to sort of escape. And it wasn't just the divorce. It was more that sort of desire for the open place. And my mom ended up there from California just kind of by happenstance.
How do people, well, right now the Dakotas are thriving because of shale oil, but mm-hmm. What kind of work were they looking for when they moved there?
My dad was interested in politics, and he's a rock-ribbed liberal, and which is increasingly uncommon there, but back then was fairly common. Both of our senators were in the 70s were George McGovern and James Aberesk, both Democrats and pretty liberal Democrats. So he was interested in politics primarily. And my mom went there to work for ACORN, the now defunct community organizing organization. So they met doing that.
So it was a hotbed of liberalism. What's changed?
Well, I don't know. I guess there's – I'm not sure exactly what's happened, but partly I think the rise of evangelical Christianity over sort of mainline Protestant churches. And I think people like me leave over the past several generations, really. Yeah.
Well, when we talk about the Great Plains, what states are we talking about?
Usually I talk about the column of states that goes to North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas, Oklahoma, but then the eastern parts of Colorado, New Mexico, Wyoming, Montana, and the southern parts of the prairie provinces in Canada, Saskatchewan, Manitoba, and even Alberta are all sort of the plains. So there's no, but my book really focuses on South Dakota, where I'm from, and the states.
But we're talking about a pretty flat area, which suddenly changes when you get to Colorado and you have the foothills of the Rockies. But
yes.
For long distances, you can drive on what feels like perfectly flat land.
Yes, it's quite flat. Though even in some parts there are rolling hills, but still the vistas are sort of just enormous.
Well,
and
the Dakotas, of course,
small.
We have all of the hills in the Dakotas.
Yeah, the Black Hills,
So you say you left. Mm-hmm. You moved east after you grew up in South Dakota.
Mm-hmm.
Why was it?
Partly because of my upbringing, both sort of my dad's politics, and then my mom is gay. So that was always something that weighed on my whole childhood. Partly their divorce, and they had a custody battle over me, but also just the secret of that I kept my whole childhood of my mom's sexuality.
Oh, you knew it fairly early, before the divorce and before she moved to Portland?
Not before the divorce. It was sort of after the divorce, but I lived with her for 3 years after my parents were divorced, during that time is when she began seeing a woman, and we kept that secret definitely then. And
well, maybe liberal politics, but fairly conservative attitudes about social matters. Did your mother become a pariah? Where were you living exactly?
I was in Aberdeen, South Dakota at that time. It's in the northeastern part of the state. And she just wasn't out. It was a secret. We kept a secret from our neighbors, landlady, all these people. So it just wasn't an issue. I suppose that a lot of people knew, but nobody said anything. And I think that's one of the things about homosexuality in places that are pretty conservative like that, is that there are gay people around, but nobody talks about it.
And later, I want to address the perhaps the most outspoken anti-gay person in America, Fred Phelps, who lives in the Great Plains.
He lives in Topeka, Kansas. They have a sort of compound there that I've tried to visit, tried to attend church there. And
the Westboro Baptist Church.
The Westboro Baptist Church. And it's a, you know, it's basically just their family, but he and his wife had 13 children, and I think only about 4 defected. So they're all part of what is essentially a cult, but it's a severely Calvinist theology, really extreme predestination sort of theology that they are holding on to.
Mm. Well, actually, one of his sons has become an outspoken atheist, which is kind of interesting. I guess that's a reaction.
That's one of the, yeah.
But you say here that you think that Fred Phelps has something in common with earlier Midwestern rabble-rousers. You compare him, for example, with William Jennings Bryan.
There's a little bit of tongue-in-cheek in that comparison, but he's a powerful, I think Fred Phelps is a powerful writer, a powerful demagogue, and he makes extreme claims a lot to get publicity, and I think William Jennings Bryan played that role as an orator and a demagogue sort of too. It's just I probably agree with more of his well, not probably, more certainly agree with more of William Jennings Bryan's beliefs, though not all.
Well, in Inherit the Wind, he comes across as something of a self-righteous demagogue, and self-righteousness is something you say is not all that uncommon in the area.
Yeah, I mean,
do you think that what does that come from?
I think there are people. I don't know. I'm not exactly sure how to characterize it, but there's a culture there of people being very timid and being modest and trying not to be boastful. But then these people appear within that culture of modesty, and there are several of them that I kind of talk about in the book that are really forceful, and it seems that they are just really popular. I don't know if it's that people kind of thirst for somebody to say what everyone's thinking deep down or something like that, or if people are just easily pliable because they're so modest. I'm not sure.
My guest is Josh Garrett Davis. His book, Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains. So Ghost Dances, they were a Native American tradition connected to the Paiute Sioux?
It was actually a brief phenomenon, you might almost say, more than a movement or tradition. It was a really short-lived religion, probably because of its tragic ending. But the Paiutes were actually out in Nevada, and there was a prophet there named Wovoka who had a revelation that with the use of this ghost dance practice, it would make the whites disappear, it would make the wildlife and the buffalo come back, and the ancestors who'd been killed. And it spread across a lot of tribes across, but in South Dakota and some Sioux, Lakota Sioux from South Dakota had made a pilgrimage out to Nevada to see him, and they brought this religion back, and it became exceedingly popular. It was a really terrible time for them. It was in the wake of all of the Indian Wars of the 1870s or 1880s, and it really scared the United States government and the military, and probably because of that fear, the government really overreacted and most epically in the Wounded Knee Massacre in 1890, which was in South Dakota. And there's a mass grave there, which, I mean, that's a pretty haunting thing to just have in your presence is a mass grave from a massacre like that.
I read some years back that the Indians of the Great Plains arrived rather late themselves, that they arrived somewhere in the 15th century. Before then, it was mostly the buffalo.
There would have been migratory trips, but I think I think the horse spread to the northern plains by, say, around 1700. And I think that that technology of the horse really opened up the plains because it's just so vast. And I mean, there are sites from much earlier, and there were definitely people living there and hunting there, but it really changed. The horse just transformed the region.
The horse came from the conquistadors.
Yeah, and spread, but not directly. It would have spread.
Where does the your subtitle, the phrase proofing up, come from?
That's a sort of popular phrase that came from the Homestead Act, which was passed during the Civil War, and allotted a homestead of 160 acres to you if you claimed it, signed up for it, and then you had to build a house and cultivate it for 5 years. And once you had done that, you got the land free and clear, and they said you proved up. And then I kind of use it as a metaphor throughout the book for different situations of kind of coming to terms, I guess.
So how many of the people in the area can look back to that time of the Homestead Act? Have many of their descendants remained, the sense I get is a lot of people have moved out and other people have moved in. And interestingly, in the light of our previous conversation, many Latino immigrants moving into the area.
Now, since, I mean, a lot of that has, at least where in South Dakota, has happened since I left in the last decade. But yeah, it's one of the kind of points that I make, and I don't know the demographic numbers of all of this tracing people in and out. It would be very difficult to trace. But it's astounding when you think about the history that we've kind of learned of a single wave of settlers and colonists moving in, staying and building up a civilization, quote unquote, on sort of blank land or land that the Indians had given up. That I don't think that that's as true as we imagine. I think there's a lot more movement in and out, and that's one of the things I discovered about the region. It's helped me make peace with my own relationship to it, too, to know that it's always been a porous place. It's always been a place where people came in, people left, and it's transforming all the time, and it continues to.
You discuss your attraction to the idea of the strong plains woman that's perpetuated by writers like Laura Ingalls Wilder, and you include one of your own relatives, Ruth Harris, mm-hmm. in that discussion. A rugged hunter?
No. She is a Methodist activist who lived here in New York City for a lot of her adult life, but I met her at family reunions in Nebraska. And because I had early, even though my parents moved from elsewhere, I had earlier ancestors who had been homesteaders or earlier settlers. And she left roughly, you know, or a little later than I did, maybe when she was 22. But she was an activist and went and lived in China and happened to be a missionary in China when the revolution happened in the late 40s and early 50s.
For me, the writer of the Plains is Willa Cather.
Yeah, I have a bit about her, too, where I talk about her high school graduation speech in particular. And she gave this remarkable speech when she was 16 and graduated, and she was the only girl in her class. And she was talking about these grand abstract concepts of superstition and investigation. And I kind of identified with her pushing back against her town or feeling constrained by her town. And I kind of saw that sort of ambition to get out was something I felt akin to.
For many people, the Great Plains also represent dinosaur bones, mm-hmm. the buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
The buffalo is making a comeback?
Definitely. I think there are maybe a third of a million now. I mean, there was a point where there were only something like 1,000 buffalo left.
Because there's been a concerted effort to bring them.
By all sorts of different people, from private ranchers to conservation organizations to Indian tribes to government.
And even bring back the Great Plains, the grasses of the Great Plains?
Yep, that's also happening, a restoration of prairie grass. I think that there are conservationists that would like to see big enough chunks preserved that they wouldn't have to manage the buffalo so tightly, that they could migrate with, you know, right now there's a drought. Maybe they would migrate to an area where there's less drought or something.
Well, who owns all of this land? Is this privately owned ranch land, or is it mostly state or federal land?
There's quite a bit of state and federal land. There's a lot of there's national grasslands that were bought back from failed homesteaders in the 30s. There are national forests, national parks. And then there are private ranches, and some people are putting conservation easements on those private lands as well.
Isn't the drought something of an ironic situation? Because this once was the site of a great inland sea, wasn't it? Is that why all those dinosaur fossils have turned up, including Tyrannosaurus Rex?
Yes, there it was a you know 70 million years ago. I guess it was a much more humid place, inland sea, and there were ferns and things like that. And there have been riches of fossils found.
You write about music being a significant part of your life. Mm-hmm. Is this a hotbed of rock and roll?
More than you might think. There are lots of small, unheard of musicians. There aren't very many famous musicians out there. But I had there was a thriving punk rock scene when I was a kid, and I got really involved in that and played in bands and went to see bands and would drive hundreds of miles to see bands. But it was amazing that bands passing through, you know, you have to stop somewhere between Missoula and Minneapolis. So
and Pierre is as good a place as any.
Right. We pronounce it pure.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Ghost Dances, Proving Up on the Great Plains, is Josh Garrett Davis's first book. This is a combination of history of the area and memoir.
Mm-hmm.
Where do you go from here?
Well, I'm in graduate school right now for history, and it's sort of a new field for me. And so I'm catching up a lot on that over this last year and this coming year, but I hope to write another book, perhaps somewhat based in the plains or the west, more of a less personal.
And the book is published by Little Brown. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Well, thanks for having me.